Well, in September, the Scottish people will vote on whether they wish to be independent from their alliance with Great Britain. And right now, the polls show that about 45% are going to vote yes, we want independence, and about 55% are going to vote no. But these numbers have been narrowing over the last year, so there's still a question as to what will happen. Some of the Scottish leaders, in referring to the need for independence from England, point to another country and say, look, they got independence in 1776, and look how well they've done. But the more educated among those know that the roots of that independence go back to Edinburgh and Glasgow and other intellectual centers in Scotland. On Friday of this week, we'll celebrate Independence Day, the anniversary of the formal Declaration of Independence of the American colonies from Great Britain. In Washington, D.C., the National Symphony Orchestra, with wonderful cellists in it, will play an outdoor concert in front of the Capitol under somewhat protection. I've seen them play during rainstorms, and this is not good for the instruments, I know, but it is a tradition. And one year they had to put on a recording because it just wasn't safe for the orchestra to be out there. But the NSO will play an outdoor concert if the weather is good in front of the Capitol. I've seen it several times. Around 9 p.m., they'll play Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. And as the overture ends, the military, a little further away from the Capitol building, will fire real cannons. There are about 700,000 people, if the weather is good, will be on the mall watching. And then fireworks will explode near the Washington Monument, lighting up the sky with bright explosions of color and light. It'll all be broadcast on national television Friday night, but many of you will not be watching television. You'll be outside watching your own fireworks displays here in Sarasota, along with people all across America watching fireworks displays in small and large towns, eating hamburgers and hot dogs and potato chips and drinking soda or beer to celebrate our independence. Well, in 1776, Thomas Jefferson arrived late to attend the meetings of the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. He was only 33 years old. He was the youngest member of the Congress. He had not been part of the original Virginia delegation, but he was sent as a substitute for another delegate who had to return to Virginia. The 11th of June, 1776, the other delegates appointed Jefferson to serve on a committee to draft the Declaration of Independence. The four other members of the committee then asked Jefferson to write the first draft. The goal of the document, the purpose of the Declaration of Independence, was to encourage the French government to provide aid to the American colonies. The colonial army was in desperate need of supplies from France. However, getting any major commitment from France was hard, while the colonies lacked international legal standing. They were not a corporate body that could enter into a contract. In international law, they were still part of England and engaged in a civil war. Aiding them would be an entry into England's internal affairs. Before the colonies could make treaties with France, they had to become a treaty-making entity, an independent country. Also, the colonists could not expect France to negotiate with 13 different colonies. 13 different treaties could not be expected. So the purpose of Congress was to create one legal confederation, with the power to make a treaty with France. And 19 months after the passing of the Declaration of Independence, the French did enter the war on the side of the American rebels. The French were hoping to weaken British power. Now, the men who voted for the Declaration of Independence had no idea how important it would become in our country's history. Today, Americans celebrate it as a key document in United States, in our United States heritage. This is primarily because of the preamble, primarily because of the first words of the document. They are a philosophical statement. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, 33-year-old Thomas Jefferson did not invent these words, these phrases. The ideas that he wrote down were the result of a series of historical events. Now, you can start this story at any point, but I want to start it in 1450, when Gutenberg completed work on a printing system using metal movable type that made books easier to print and cheaper to own. Then in 1534, Martin Luther completed his translation of the Bible into German, encouraging all Protestants to learn to read so that they could have direct access to the Bible. A few years later, in 1560, John Knox, the great reformer of the Scottish Church, came back from Geneva bringing this idea that everyone should read the Bible, direct contact with the Scripture, bringing it back to Scotland. And he was determined to produce a Bible in English in Scotland. The New Testament was completed in 1557, and the complete Bible was first published in 1560. It became known as the Geneva Bible. John Knox called for a national system of education in Scotland so that everyone could read his Bible and have direct access to the Scripture. Well, it took over 100 years, but in 1696, following John Knox's recommendation, the Scottish Parliament, controlled by then by Presbyterians, voted to establish a school in every parish in Scotland, so that everyone could learn to read and could read the Holy Scripture. Because of this system of free education, Scotland became Europe's first modern literate society. In 1698, the leaders decided that they needed to have their own colony in the New World, the Scottish leaders thought. England has all of these colonies, and then Portugal, and even France has colonies, but we don't have any colonies. We need a colony. And so they looked at the map, and they said, nobody has colonized Panama. This is a strategic location between the two oceans. So they invested all the wealth of Scotland. They actually put it all in a big iron box. They were asked to bring in their jewels and their money and combine it. And you can still see this box that they put the money in the Scottish Museum in Edinburgh. They put it all in the box, and they used this money to finance an expedition to Panama, to colonize Panama. And the expedition was a complete disaster, as they all got yellow fever and died, and it bankrupted the country. This played a leading role in convincing the Scots that perhaps a union with England was a good idea. So when you wonder, how did Scotland become part of England that they're voting now to become independent from, it was because they tried to start a colony in Panama and failed to do so and became bankrupt. And in 1709, the union was formed of the United Kingdom of Great Britain, 1707. Well, the Scots, I don't think, realized what a good deal this was for them when they started this. But this meant that the tariffs, the taxes that they had to pay to trade with the American colonies, were now gone, abolished. And the Scots were very good shipbuilders, especially in Glasgow. So they built the fastest, best ships and went back and forth to Virginia and picked up tobacco in these ships and brought it to Europe. And they became the center of trade in nicotine in Europe, the trade of tobacco. Of course, this was made especially profitable because free Africans were turned into slaves and forced to provide their labor for free in Virginia. So out of this free labor and these excellent ships and the lack of tariffs, Scotland became wealthy, and the addiction, of course, to nicotine through tobacco. Scotland became wealthy. But meanwhile, because of John Knox and the Presbyterians, most Scottish people had learned to read. And you may have had this experience with your children when you teach them to read and they read one book and they finish it, they say, "So what else is there? What about some other books?" And the Scottish people had the same reaction. Having learned to read and learned to read the Bible, they finished that and they said, "So what about some other books? Now that we have this skill, let's use it." With universal literacy, writers in Scotland wrote not just for a few intellectuals, but for the general public. And with the wealth of Scotland and this interest in reading, there was an explosion of writing and publishing in Scotland. By the 1750s, virtually every town of any size in Scotland had a local lending library. In Edinburgh, the book trade became an important part of the local economy. There were 6 publishing houses operating in the city by 1763. By 1790, there were 16 publishing houses in operation. Papermaking became a mainstay of the national economy. The Scottish universities became international centers of learning and drew students from across Protestant Europe. And we think about books like the Encyclopedia Britannica as coming out of London, but the first publication of the Encyclopedia Britannica was the printing presses in Edinburgh. We think of books like Darwin's Origin of the Species as being published in England, but it was published for the first time in 1859 in Scotland. The flow of money from the tobacco trade, combined with this nearly universal literacy, led to the funding of universities in Edinburgh and Glasgow and St. Andrews, and it led to the Scottish Enlightenment. At the University of Glasgow, a Presbyterian minister, Reverend Francis Hutcheson, became a professor of theology. And Hutcheson argued in his lectures and in his writings that beside our five senses of seeing and hearing, touching, tasting, and smelling, God created humans with a sixth sense. We are born, he said, with a sense that grasps nature's moral laws. We are born as babies with a sense that grasps nature's moral laws. All human beings, he argued, are born with this sixth sense, this moral sense. We are created with a fundamental understanding of the nature of right and wrong. Hutcheson argued that our physical senses make us unequal. Some of us are taller than others, and to some degree, that has an advantage. Some of us are stronger than others. Some of us have trouble seeing. Some of us have trouble hearing, and so on. Those physical differences make us unequal in our relationships. And when we look just at our physical differences, it's hard to argue philosophically that all people are created equal. However, Hutcherson said these physical differences are not important. Our moral sense is our most important sense because it makes us all equals. Because we are all born with a moral sense, he said, we don't need a king. We don't need a queen to rule us. Using our moral sense, he argued, we can govern ourselves. Francis Hutcheson did not stop here. He said that the ultimate goal in our lives, the purpose of our lives, is happiness. Now, he does not, however, mean by happiness physical pleasure. He believed that by helping others, we become happy. Our moral sense tells us that the goal of our life is to be happy, and that we become happy when we are kind, when we are benevolent, when we're caring towards other people. This positive view of human nature became a key idea of the Scottish Enlightenment. Francis Hutcheson, this Presbyterian minister, said, we only find true happiness when we help others. This provides the basis, he said, for all social organization, because we can only pursue happiness if we are free to help others. Therefore, he strongly opposed restrictions on the freedom of women. He argued that human rights are universal and do not recognize any distinction based on gender. He strongly opposed slavery, arguing that the greatest cause of unhappiness in the world is slavery. He believed in maximizing personal liberty so that all of us would be free to pursue happiness by helping others. He was the first to say, that action is best, which accomplishes the greatest happiness for the greatest numbers. That action is best, which accomplishes the greatest happiness for the greatest numbers. And he believed that happiness was created by helping others. He died in 1746, but his ideas lived on in the works of other Scottish Enlightenment philosophers. In Edinburgh, David Hume substituted the word heart for Francis Hutcheson's phrase moral sense. Hume argued that the heart, that the head discerns fact and our heart discerns right, and that therefore the heart is superior to the head. In Aberdeen, Thomas Reed substituted the phrase common sense and self-evident truths for Francis Hutcheson's phrase moral sense. Reed argued that the basic moral perceptions of common people are equal and as valid as those of philosophers and scientists. He argued for the value of common sense in common people, self-evident truths in all of us, not just in the intellectual elite. In the 1750s and 1760s, the tobacco trade resulted in frequent contact between citizens in Scotland and citizens in Virginia. One who came from Scotland to Virginia in 1758 was a man named William Small. After college in Aberdeen, Scotland, William Small came to Williamsburg, Virginia at the age of 24. He came to teach mathematics at the College of William and Mary. However, there was, as happens in universities and colleges, there was a faculty fight, and all the other faculty members left. And the College of William and Mary was left with one professor, William Small, 24 years old. He was the professor of everything. Thomas Jefferson arrived as an undergraduate at the College of William and Mary in 1760. He was 16 years old. In his autobiography, Jefferson wrote, "It was my good fortune and what probably fixed the destinies of my life that Dr. William Small of Scotland was then professor of mathematics. Because of Dr. Small, Jefferson studied the ideas of Francis Hutcheson, of Thomas Reed, and David Hume." When Jefferson arrived in Philadelphia in May of 1776, he had been studying these Scottish Enlightenment philosophers for 16 years. But he wasn't alone. Out of the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence, 21 came from Scottish backgrounds. The most famous of these was John Witherspoon, who was president of Princeton University. He had moved from Scotland to Princeton in 1768. Witherspoon used the University of Edinburgh as a model for the design of classes at Princeton University. When Jefferson circulated his draft of the Declaration of Independence, many in the room were familiar with the phrases and sentences he used. He wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." Those in the room who were familiar with the works of Thomas Reed recognized that the word self-evident had come from the writings of Thomas Reed. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal." Jefferson took this idea from Francis Hutcheson, who had argued that whether we are male or female or black or white or tall or short, God created everyone equal with the same moral sense. To complete the sentence, Jefferson then referred to Francis Hutcheson's belief that the purpose of our life is to pursue happiness by helping others, and to Hutcheson's belief that we can help others only if we are free, that is, only if we have liberty, only if we are not ruled by a king or a queen. Jefferson wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." This week we will celebrate this statement about human nature that comes directly out of the thinking of the Scottish Enlightenment. But 250 years later, do we still agree with Francis Hutcheson? Do we believe that we are all created equal? That we are all born with a sixth sense, a moral sense? Are we born knowing the difference between right and wrong? Well, these days, people conduct scientific research on these questions. The Yale Infant Cognitive Center is particularly interested in one of the most exalted social functions, ethical judgments, and whether babies are hardwired to make them. The lab's initial study along these lines were published in 2007. In the journal Nature, startling the scientific world by showing that in a series of simple morality plays, 6 and 10 month olds overwhelmingly preferred good guys to bad guys. This capacity may serve as the foundation for moral thought and action, the authors wrote. It may form an essential basis for more abstract concepts of right and wrong. So modern research supports the ideals expressed in the first words of the Declaration of Independence. We are equal in the sense that most of us are born with an understanding of what is right and wrong. an intuitive understanding of what is right and wrong. But do we agree with Hutchinson that the purpose of life is to pursue happiness by helping others? Well, scientists are working on this, and lots of new books have been published about happiness in the last 15 years or so. Martin Seligman, in his book Authentic Happiness, wrote that the students in one of his classrooms wondered if happiness comes more from the exercise of kindness than it does from having fun. Each student undertook an assignment for the next class to engage in one pleasurable activity and one charitable activity, and to write about them both. It turned out that the afterglow of the pleasurable activity, such as hanging out with friends or watching a movie or eating a hot fudge sundae, that these pleasures paled in comparisons with the effects of acts of kindness. The students found that when their charitable acts were spontaneous and called upon their personal strengths, their whole day went better. One student told about how her nephew asked for help with his third grade arithmetic. After an hour of tutoring, she was astonished to discover that for the rest of the day, she could listen better, she was mellower, and people liked her much more than usual. A business student said that he came to the university to learn how to make a lot of money in order to be happy, but he was floored to find that he liked helping other people more than spending his money shopping or hanging out with friends. Finally, do we agree with Hutchinson's moral imperative? Do we agree that the action is best when that action is best, which accomplishes the greatest happiness for the greatest numbers? Do we agree that action is best, which accomplishes the greatest happiness for the greatest numbers? Well, in my imagination, I would like to take some of our political leaders to Scotland. I would like to teach them a little bit about the Scottish Enlightenment and how it influenced our founders. And in my imagination, then, I would take them to the Edinburgh Hospital, where on several occasions I visited Scottish Unitarians. The hospital is run by the National Health Service. And I would talk to our political leaders about Hutchinson's moral imperative, that action is best which accomplishes the greatest happiness for the greatest numbers. We can still learn from Scotland. Friday evening, the people of the United States will celebrate the words of the Declaration of Independence. In Washington, the NSO will play a concert outside in front of the Capitol. Around 9 p.m., they'll play Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. Now, Tchaikovsky wrote the music to commemorate the unsuccessful French invasion into Russia. The overture ends with the orchestra playing the anthem, God Save the Tsar. However, Americans like to hear the overture on the 4th of July because we like cannon fire. So our music on the 4th of July is from Russia. Our fireworks are from China. And the ideas we celebrate, they came from Glasgow and Aberdeen and Edinburgh.